they're retired.
Except for Tom Brady, who's 44, but he's a quarterback.
Well, he gets hit a lot less. Yeah.
Yeah, he gets hit, and his skills are basically throwing the football and some maneuverability, but he's not out there running. You don't see 44-year-old running backs or 44-year-old linebackers.
No, sir.
Does not happen.
No.
But people are getting fit at older ages and doing things at ages that people would not have done before.
Oh, my partner, a while back, he's retired now. He was 92, I believe, 3 years ago before COVID, and he won a world set the world record in deadlift and bench press.
Really? At what age?
Dr. Donald Dreyer, at 92.
At 92?
He set the world record.
I bet he could bench press his weight at 92.
Just about.
Yeah. Jack LaLanne said he could do it when he was 95, and he died at 96. No, eventually it was respiratory issues that went south on him. We might hear a little from him. I used to interview him every year on his birthday, September 26th. Unfortunately, Jack's unavailable. He died 10 years ago, so that's why we have Dr. Corbin, who's Baton Rouge's version of Jack LaLanne. But he would be the first to note he had lung issues at the end. He didn't smoke, but things wear out. And having good lung power is important for something like weightlifting. If you don't have good lung power, you're not going to be able to lift many weights, are you?
Your aerobic capacity is more important than ever as we age. I used to bodybuild, and you know, I could do 21 pull-ups, I could do, you know, 50 push-ups, 50 dips, but about the age of 39 that started to fail. So
really,
I've switched over to more aerobic.
You don't do pull-ups anymore?
Not many. Well, every now and then I'll see how many I can do.
Yeah.
And I can still do a few.
You know, now the Marines only require 3?
No.
Yeah.
Three. One of my partners, Dr. Baylor Jewell, his son joined the Marines, and he's been doing pull-ups, trying to get to 10.
Well, I was in Marine ROTC, and 10 would have been a putrid performance. But when I started, I couldn't do any. I was in high school,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, but it helped me realize the importance of doing things other than running, and it's been a lifelong thing now. And the great thing about strength is you can keep that longer. You know, you're definitely going to slow down no matter what you do. But a person who works at it can be as strong at 80 or 90 as he or she was at 30 or 40.
If you keep your tensile strength, the muscle strength up, as you get older, you can keep it up if you work at it. But you got to keep the flexibility up as well. If you don't keep the flexibility up, the strength will not follow.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Kip Corbin. And a listener, this is Tom on Blue Bonnet, saying, yes, the Marines now require only 3 pull-ups, but they have 3 good ones. You have to get your whole head above the bar. Now, does it count if you just get a portion of your head over the bar? Does that count as one, or you'd get disqualified?
We called them chin-ups for a reason, because you had to get your chin over the bar.
Chin over the bar. It doesn't count.
That's right.
Okay. Well, what's the best thing to do to keep that flexibility?
There's something called the Williams Flexion Exercise Group, basically the gold standard for back and hip flexibility. It involves lying down non-weight bearing to the spine. And you pull your knee to your chest, and one at a time, and then both. And you do rotational stretches and core strength, basically isometrics. But it's mm-hmm. the gold standard.
All right. Another listener, Holly in the Garden District, asks about heredity. We're all victims. If we want to live a long life, choose our parents very carefully, as they say. But how much does heredity play in these other matters?
Heredity is a lot. I mean, I've seen people in their 60s that can't even get up and down off the floor. And then other people, they can do it. And doesn't necessarily mean that both of these people didn't exercise, but some people just wear out quicker.
And that has a lot to do with who our parents are.
That is mostly to do with who our parents are.
And injuries. You operate on people, right?
I do mostly spinal decompression these days. These new decompression tables have been shown to reduce disc herniation size get the pressure off nerves, and realign the spine, all with very precise movements. Loyola School of Medicine in Chicago did a 3-year study. Every person was MRI'd before treatment, then they had an MRI after treatment, in which they compared the MRIs. They had almost a 90% success rate in changing the size of the disc herniations. And the head of orthopedic surgery who oversaw the study at Loyola said the number of referrals for back surgery were cut by 50%.
Really?
That's amazing.
And people who have back surgery know it's an uneven process. It works for some, doesn't work for others. And sounds like this is in lieu of that and may actually be more effective.
It technically is more effective, but some people just have to have surgery. The problem with it is in the back, you can't go through the front. You have to go through the back. And there's nerves and bones in the way of the disc. So if they want to trim the disc, it's hard to get to. And it makes the surgery success rate a little lower than other types of surgeries. They estimate approximately 50% of people who undergo surgery will have to undergo another surgery.
Wow. But it should be, based on what you're telling me, Dr. Corbin, a last resort rather than a first option.
It should be, yes. And that's what we're moving to.
All right. This is another listener, our friend Hal in Monroe, saying that quite often pain in a certain area is not reflective of a problem in that area. Like you might have back pain and it's something radiating from another part of your body. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Most back pain or surgery for backs is done to relieve leg pain, not necessarily back pain. If you have a pinched nerve, sciatic nerve, everybody's heard of sciatica, the surgery is designed to relieve that leg pain, get the pressure off the nerve. It doesn't necessarily address the facet joints and the other problems that can be in there, arthritis, old injury, scar tissue. In fact, when you do the surgery, it actually creates more scar tissue, and that's an unavoidable side effect.
All right. Well, I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune condition and is something that's happened to a few members of my family, but I continue to work out and do it vigorously. And now with the medication, I take Xeljanz. I don't have any real problems. But I know at some point, if I live long enough, it'll probably get me. But am I doing the right thing by pushing it, or should I just kind of relax and let nature take its course?
Benjamin Franklin said, if you don't use it, you lose it. So keep fighting. Keep it up.
Well, I like that. I'd much rather have that than say just shut it down and you might hurt yourself. I don't like that.
Well, we're all going to hurt ourselves no matter what, eventually, if we live long enough, like you said. And so if you keep it moving, it'll move for you.
Yeah.
And it's got to last you a number of years. What's the average age now, 80?
Average, well, that's what it was before COVID and and before opioid stuff.
Oh, God.
Now, for the first time in a century, the lifespan has gone down in the U.S. the last 2 years. And for men, we actually have a lower lifespan in the United States than does the great country of Cuba, which tells us that a lot of us aren't taking as good a care of ourselves as we should.
Too much pleasure.
Too much pleasure. Too much food and not enough exercise.
That's exactly right.
Well, and can you catch up? Let's say somebody's been on the sidelines for 20 or 30 years. Can they catch up, or is it too late?
There's something called muscle memory, and it's a good thing and a bad thing. In the muscle memory, if you want to regain what you had, it's not hard to do. If you want to put new stuff on, it's harder when you age, but you can regain.
And we'll be back in 90 seconds with Dr. Corbin. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Another segment with Dr. Kip Corbin, chiropractor for the Stars. Many of the LSU Stars through the years have used his services and his talents and his expertise. And if you'd like to get it in our remaining segment with him, 877-217-5757. I mentioned your work with LSU athletes, particularly women, and they won all those NCAA championships in the 80s and 90s, primarily under Pat Henry. And one of your proteges was Sheila Eccles, 1988 Olympic gold medalist. And she not only was an Olympic gold medalist, I think is the only LSU person, as Tiger Rag reported in its last issue, her current issue, that she was indoor and outdoor national champion, right?
She won the indoor and outdoor SEC, and she also won gold medal in 88, 89. She won gold medal in the World Cup, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And one of the reasons LSU had got me to work with the team was because I did gait analysis. And back in the day, in the late 80s, early 90s, all we had was VHS. And when you slowed it down, the picture got very grainy. It's very hard to tell. So what we have now, I can do better with my phone now than I could do with all the equipment we had back then. But her posture was so perfect. When she ran, there was almost nothing to comment about. Her head was straight. She held her shoulders erect and put all the power in her legs.
And probably, what, five? She's not a tall girl.
No, she's about 5'3".
But a lot of power in that body.
Yeah, she did. She could fly.
And you also worked with my friend who used to work with me, Kim Carter, Olympian, 1992 in Barcelona. And she was about a foot taller than
Kim was tall.
than Sheila. And what an amazing physical specimen she was and is.
Wasn't she a heptathlete?
Yeah.
Yes. She was really great. In the 92 Olympics, I was in charge of the physical therapy, chiropractic, massage therapy tent. We had tents, MASH tents, air conditioned too. It was held in New Orleans. And they would all come in there to get their treatment between races or between events. And she was dating, I believe, Sheldon
Blockberger,
who became
greatest decathlete in LSU history.
Yeah, he was fantastic. And we also had a little blow up on that 92 Olympic trials.
Really?
Dan and Dave, the duo, the pentathlete.
They were decathletes.
Decathletes. And Nike was pushing them, man. They expected gold and silver, you know. And Dan, I believe it was Dan, all he had to do with the pole vault was just clear the lowest level. So he skipped the first two jumps. And he knocked the bar over. It lost his bid for the Olympics.
Wow.
And just blew up a whole bunch of...
Yeah, and that's always so...
That was
so
disheartening.
Tragic. Well, we have some folks waiting in line. Please be brief. We've got Dr. Corbin at the ready. He's the back guy, and we're going to have him back soon, I hope. Dan downtown. Dan, not the Dan who was in the Olympic trials, but Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning. Regarding muscle memory, when I was a kid, I had a ping pong table, and I didn't play for 50 years until I went to the council on aging in order to mostly get a free lunch. And lo and behold, there's a ping pong table, and I started playing again, and I've lost 30 pounds. It's been great.
There's your muscle memory right there. See, you got it back. It's hard to build new muscle when you age, but you can get most or some of that muscle you had. And that stuff back because of the muscle memory. Mm-hmm. Now, in a bad situation, if you sprain an ankle pretty bad and you limp for a long time while it's healing, your muscles will learn that too. So that's one of the muscle memories that we're not too fond of.
Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on with Dr. Corbin.
Good morning, doctor. My question is, I have slip disc, right side, bone spurs, arthritis. I'm thinking about going to Mexico for the stem cell. What's your opinion on that?
Stem cell is, it's not FDA approved. I don't think it's even FDA cleared. It may be cleared, but they have had some success with it, but not all that much. It may grow some cartilage back in there, and that may help you some. But on the other hand, it's not a very dangerous procedure.
All right, James and Metairie. Thank you, Mike. Good luck to you. James and Metairie, you're on with Dr. Corbin.
Well, good morning to you, Jim, and to your guest. I have something called lumbar stenosis. I guess it's a narrowing of the channels through which the nerves travel from the spinal cord. And with some physical therapy, things have worked out pretty well for me. But I want to ask a question, and that is the obesity rate in the United States of America is around 40%. I walk around and I see people. I mean, I'm almost grossed out. I don't know. That's got to be a cause of back pain in some individuals, isn't it?
It's like carrying a backpack around all day, except on your front. And you ask any soldier after they've carried those 40 to 70-pound backpacks around how their back feels.
And that waist circumference is almost always a
It can be an indicator of heart disease and other things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's
obesity, especially around the waist, heart disease, sugar problems, things like that.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to get under the wire with Dr. Kip Corbin, doctor to many of the LSU icons through the years. This is Tracy at the Capitol. Dry needling. Is that good?
Yes, dry needling we use. I probably do 10 to 15 dry needles a day.
Really?
Yes.
How do you do that?
Well, it's basically a form of acupuncture. It's a limited form. We only go after physical conditions with that. You don't try and treat like a family practitioner might, like they may do in China.
Mm-hmm.
But we do it for local pain. I did several yesterday for shoulder, rotator cuff problems, and a couple of headaches. And it seems to work real well.
So it works all over the body.
It can, yes.
Okay. Paul in Opelousas. Hi, Paul. Good morning.
Just a question to you, doctor.
Yes, sir.
How do you like to get paid? Preparing now for pre-retirement, just looking at the procedure for setting up paying medical bills. What's the best recipe that can be applied for someone about to walk into retirement? Thank you very much.
All right. What about?
Well, Medicare obviously is going to be your go-to. Mm-hmm. You should have a supplemental there. It really does help, especially with your medication.
And for things like what you do, this isn't cosmetic surgery.
No.
You can get your insurance provider to take care of it if you've got a condition.
You can get your back fixed, yes.
Yeah, you can get your back fixed.
And
that's good.
The caller had mentioned spinal stenosis.
Yeah.
Loyola School of Medicine in Chicago just finished a long study, several years long, where they used organ donor cadavers to treat with Cox flexion distraction spinal decompression. And they found they were getting 2 to 4 millimeters of increased space between the vertebrae by using this particular technique. It's just now being released. It's going to clinical trials now on real live people. Cadavers, if they were able to get 2 to 4 millimeters on a cadaver, think of what they can do with live tissue.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dr. Corbin, and let's keep it going. And you're my go-to guy now that my friend Jack LaLanne, the pride of Morro Bay, California, has died at 96, 10 years ago. He'd be 107 on Sunday if he had lived.
Goodness.
September 26th. And Alondra Villarreal's gone back into the archives for Jack Henri LaLanne. Do we have Jack? Jack is back.
Now that I have a date to come into your home every day, we do have a date, I hope. Will you promise me something right now? Say, Jack, I promise that I'm going to let you come into my home for at least this week, this 5 days, today through Friday. And if you're not more than satisfied with how you're going to feel and what I'm going to show you and going to help you with, then forget about it. You can turn on a Westerner or something else, some comic, you know, where you can be entertained. I'm not here to entertain you. I'm here to help you. But I'm sure that you will be more than satisfied with the results you're going to get. As long as we're close friends, and if you let someone come into your home, you know, you like to know a little something about them. Well, I have been in this profession of nutrition and physical culture work for over 20 years. For the first 15 years of my life, I was not expected to live on several occasions. In fact, I'm going to tell you the story next Friday, but when I talk to you about aches and pains and about disease, well, I've really had my share of them.
That's Jack LaLanne, and he made it 96 years with a lifespan that shouldn't have gone that long. His relatives died in their 30s,
wow,
and he did it well. As have you, Dr. Corbin. Let's talk again soon, and we'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this quick pause.
Thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're joined now by Dr. Wendy Suzuki. We go from the back doctor, Kip Corbin, to Dr. Suzuki, who specializes in matters of the mind and the spirit and the head. She's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. She's a celebrated international authority on neuroplasticity and recently named one of the 10 women changing the way we see the world by good housekeeping. And her book is Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Good morning, Dr. Suzuki.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. And for those who'd like to talk to this erudite doctor, 877-217-5757 is your number. Now, most people probably don't appreciate the fact that there might be something that we would term good anxiety. Is there anything that is good about it?
Absolutely. I titled my book Good Anxiety because from an evolutionary perspective, our that emotion of anxiety and the underlying physiological stress response that comes with it evolved to protect us from the threats of our lives. And I know many people are thinking, I'm not feeling protected at all from my with my anxiety. But that is because in our modern society, our anxiety levels have been turned up so much by the pandemic, by climate change, by all the things that come at us all the time. And so what can be protective and really essential for our lives has become a burden. And so that's why I wrote the book, to show people and to really change mindsets about the power of our anxiety. It is a critical emotion.
You write in the book, my early days of investigating and writing on this subject began in my lab as a neuroscientist at NYU. At the time, I never really thought of myself as being an anxious person. That is, until I started to notice the words used by my subjects, friends, lab members, colleagues, and even myself to describe how we were all feeling. Words like worried, on edge, stressed out, distracted, bored, pessimistic, unmotivated, nervous, ready to snap, defensive, frightened, unable to sleep. And you pose the question, sound familiar? And a simple Google search shows that 18% of the American population, 40 million people, suffer from one of several anxiety disorders, including panic disorder, PTSD, and others. Now, this is obviously a factor that affects our lives and society at large.
Yes, it is. And I'm so glad you brought up the 40 million people that have clinical levels of anxiety. This is debilitating anxiety that you need to get medical assistance with. But as we all know, anxiety exists on a wide spectrum. And I wrote this book, Good Anxiety, for what I call everyday anxiety, people that are suffering from everyday anxiety. So this is not a cure for clinical anxiety. Again, you need, you know, medical assistance. But so many of us, in fact, essentially all of us, are suffering from higher levels of what I call this everyday anxiety, which today more than ever, we need a new way to look at anxiety, to kind of harness the power within it. And so that's who the book is for. That's why I wrote the book. And as you said, I was an anxiety denier. I think there's a lot of people out there. I wanted to project the image of, no, there's nothing wrong. Everything's good here. But in fact, I had high levels of anxiety as well.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Wendy Suzuki. And we will go to the phone lines in a moment. But the book is Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Emails at talk@talklouisiana.org. Now, this is Maria in Tara saying that if your partner is anxious, if you're if married couples or others, does that cause the other person to get more anxious than they otherwise would?
Yes, and that's a wonderful opportunity to use one of the 40 strategies that I talk about in the book for turning the volume down. And I'm going to share my number one strategy for immediate ability to turn that anxiety down. And that is the activation of part of our nervous system. We all have it. It is the stress reducing part of the nervous system. I think people don't realize they have a part of their nervous system that decreases their stress. It's called the parasympathetic nervous system. And it actually works after you've been activated with stress. This part of your nervous system literally calms you down. And the best way to activate that is simply to breathe deeply. Breathe deeply and long and in a long fashion. I recommend a boxed breathing technique where you inhale slowly for four counts, hold it for four, exhale for four, and hold it for four at the bottom. This is something that you can, you know, invite your spouse to do. Practice it on yourself. You'll see there's an immediate relief of those feelings of anxiety, because you are activating your parasympathetic nervous system and other things start to kick in. Not only will your respiration rate go down because you are consciously bringing it down, but that will come with a decreased heart rate. Parasympathetic system starts to push blood from your muscles back to your digestion and reproductive organs, and works to calm us down. That's my number one tip. There are 39 more in the book that you and a spouse that may have anxiety can do together.
Elaine on College Drive. Hi, Elaine. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Wendy Suzuki. Elaine?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. Okay, great. I love that you're talking about breathing as a strategy, your number one strategy for dealing with stress and anxiety. I would like to hear what you'd say about the combination of stretching and breathing as a technique for reducing anxiety, and how long does someone need to do that in order to see benefits?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you've now hit my number one, breathing, and my number two, movement, ways to decrease anxiety. So I just explained why breathing is decreasing your anxiety. It is activation of the parasympathetic system. I've studied for many years in my lab the effects of moving your body, including stretching. I've studied more in-depth aerobic activity, the kinds of movements that get your heart rate up, including a power walk, you know, just walking and moving your body can do this as well. And this is using a slightly different mechanism. So moving your body, walking outside, walking around your dining room table if you're in isolation, decreases your anxiety because it is literally releasing a whole bunch of beneficial neurochemicals in your brain. Neurochemicals like the neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, and noradrenaline. And I like to give the imagery of this. Every time you move your body, it's like giving your brain a wonderful bubble bath of neurochemicals. This bubble bath will decrease your anxiety levels. And I've seen it work directly in my NYU classrooms. I had my students, these were incoming freshmen, take a quick anxiety survey. We all stood up on Zoom. We did 10 minutes of workout because I happen to be a certified fitness instructor as well. And then at the end of that 10 minutes, they took the anxiety survey again. And what I found is before the workout, this was right before they were about to start their first freshman year on Zoom, they were anxious. They were indeed just shy of clinically anxious on the scale that they all took. 10 minutes of exercise decreased their anxiety level to normal range. That was just 10 minutes. So to go back to your question, stretching and breathing are kind of embracing both of those elements. And how long do you need to do it? Well, you know, I say that I encourage people to do self experimentation. So breath work, how long does the slow breathing help calm you down? It may depend on how anxious you are to start, how long of a stretching session, moving your body with deep breathing is working. Again, might depend on exactly what anxiety level you start, but I can guarantee that both of those things are working in tandem, in parallel, to reduce your anxiety level.
All right. Now, in the book, you define what you call positive stress response as opposed to tolerable stress response and toxic stress response. What are the distinctions?
Yeah. So I'm just going to take two of those. So toxic stress response is kind of what we're all familiar with, that worry with anxiety that just leads to more worry and a bad feeling in your stomach. And literally that bad feeling is your stress response system that is shifting blood from your digestive system out to your muscles. That's why your stomach is starting to feel queasy and not doing well. How do I shift that into positive anxiety, good anxiety? And that is, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes some rethinking of what this anxiety is good for. But my personal example is, you know, some of, in fact, all of the best talk.
All right. We want to get Phil in Jefferson Terrace. He's been waiting for a few minutes. He's a big fan of Wendy Suzuki. Phil, please be brief. You're on the air with Dr. Suzuki.
Thank you, Jim, and good morning. I have a question about meditation. Now, I understand that meditation, the technique can be learned, and that it's something that is really beneficial.
All right. What about meditation? Is that something you advocate?
Absolutely. In fact, breath is one of the oldest forms of meditation. So that boxed breathing that we just talked about is a form of meditation, and other forms of meditation can also decrease your anxiety. So I'm a big proponent, and lots of research supports that.
It's an important book, Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Most Misunderstood Emotion, from Dr. Wendy Suzuki, including 40 strategies for making anxiety work for us. So we appreciate your work, and glad to spend some time with you. Thanks for your insights today, Dr. Suzuki.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. And after the break, we'll continue with this topic with Nancy Collier. Her book is Can't Stop Thinking, How to Let Go of Anxiety. So it should be an interesting continuation of the discussion with Dr. Suzuki. 877-217-5757 is your number. We're back in 2 minutes with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We're joined now by Nancy Collier. Her book is Can't Stop Thinking, How to Let Go of Anxiety and Free Yourself from Obsessive Rumination. Deepak Chopra writes of this book, read it and experience the freedom to create your own reality. And good morning to you, Nancy.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, and this is a topic that we were addressing in the previous segment, but anxiety is something that I think is universal. It's just a matter of degree, and you say that we can actually get rid of it. How do we do that?
Well, I don't know if I'd go as far as to say remove it, but I would say that a lot of our anxiety can be lessened if we change our relationship with our thoughts. The thing is, we all have these really active minds. We call them monkey minds. You know, they jump around, and about 95% of what they're telling us during the day is pretty awful stuff. And that's just the human condition. They're scaring us. They're telling us sort of critical things. They have grievances. I'm talking about the mind when I say this. So when we believe everything coming out of our mind, when we feel like we have to follow every thought, every catastrophic thought, we're generally working ourselves up into a lather of anxiety. So what the book talks about is, how is it possible to have these thoughts being fired at us all the time, but as the one listening to those thoughts, be able to say, no, you know, I don't feel like being terrified today, or I don't feel like being worked up, or I don't feel like hearing for the 412th time what's wrong with that person, or trying to figure out something that's gone wrong and going through it again and again. Our thoughts whip us up into anxiety. So once we realize that we're not our thoughts, that we're separate from them and we can actually choose them, that's the fundamental shift. Then we don't have to be anxious all the time.
All right. You say to our listeners and to your readers, are you stuck inside your own head? And you believe that we can learn how to stop obsessing and start really living with more pleasure if we take some common sense steps. But sometimes those steps are easier said than done. How do we make sure that we follow through?
Right. Well, none of this is easy. I'm not here to say we, from the time we're born, we're trained to believe that we are our thoughts. Thought comes into our consciousness. There's no us and it, right? So it's programmed into us. It's also programmed into us that the more we know, the more we think through things, the better off we'll be, that it's actually a good thing to be thinking all the time. You know, our parents tell us, you know, what were you thinking? Were you think when something goes wrong? But what I'm suggesting in this book is that when we realize that sometimes thinking more about a potential problem might not be the way to get to peace, even though that's what we're told, just think about it more. But very often we thought things through as many times as we can possibly think them through. And that refuge or peace comes through, hey, I don't know. I can't figure this out. It's really paradoxical. The other thing, too, is that, you know, we're all the time writing a narrative about what's happening in our lives. You know, we have a pain in our foot. And within 30 seconds, you know, the pain means we're dying of something dreadful, or, you know, I have to start getting my affairs in order. We're off and running. And for most people, it's usually nowhere good. So part of what the book talks about, too, is how do we just be in the present moment? Just what's happening right here? Don't add anything onto it. Don't write a story about it, you know, with which you are the actor, the director, the writer. Just what's happening? I have a pain in my foot. That's all I know. When we simplify life in that way, catch our stories, catch what we're adding on and how we're terrifying ourselves all the time, life gets a lot simpler and we're actually in it. We're not being kidnapped all the time by our thoughts.
All right, Barry in Mid-City, you're on with Nancy Collier. Barry, good morning to you.
Hey, Nancy, love what you're saying. In Psalm 46 in the Torah, in the Bible, verse 10, it says, as I'm sure you know, be still and know that I am God.
All right. Spiritual components are often helpful for people who are anxious. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what you're saying there, which is so true, is that when we get still and we drop out of all the thinking, all of what we're trained to do, you know, think more about it, go back down into the rabbit hole, work it through again. But when we stop, we get still. And for some people, that's feel the sensations in your body. For other people, maybe it's prayer or whatever. But that get still is the place where we find peace, when we drop out of thinking.
Nancy Collier, thank you so much. One of the leading psychotherapists in the country. She has something in the book that we're referring to, Can't Stop Thinking, called Practice Probabilities. She writes, our fear-based, future-related thoughts poison the present moment and turn it into something that it isn't, something both dreadful and imaginary. We thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll have a return visit from Nancy Collier. Our pleasure. And we're joined now in our remaining moments this hour by Paul Hawken, the New York Times best-selling creator of Drawdown and one of the environmental movement's leading voices, and his latest work is Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. And for those of us who live in South Louisiana, we know that the hurricanes are coming faster and more furiously, a direct product of climate change. Paul Hawken, how can we change this? You say in one generation. Is that possible?
What's possible in one generation is for humanity to go in the right direction at the right rate and speed, and know that what we're doing is reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and restoring ecosystems and forests and farmlands and so forth at such a rate that will take us to where we need to go in 2030, 2040, 2050. So that's ending the climate crisis. The crisis is we're going backwards. And the crisis is that things are getting worse. And the crisis is that 98% of people are not involved and disengaged. And from the Earth's point of view, there's no difference between a climate denier and somebody who gets it and understands it and doesn't do anything, and that's where we are right now.
Paul, you contend that transforming the climate crisis means mending the vital relationships and understandings between people and reconnecting humanity and nature and restoring nature itself. Now, that makes sense, but as you know, there's a lot of heavy lifting involved in that paragraph.
Well, yeah, because that's English language. But in fact, you know, on a personal level, on a familial level, community level, and so forth, it's actually quite, it's an interesting thing. It's not heavy lifting. It's about listening. It's about respect. And it's about engagement. It's about doing stuff. And I think that, you know, the climate conversation, certainly amongst privileged, so-called privileged people, is very much about thinking and worrying and stressing and understandable given the science, but so forth, but it doesn't do anything. And as long as you look at it as something that's happening to you, understandable again, you know, instead of happening for us, there's, you're either the object or the subject. And when you become the subject, you go, you act. And what's important about regeneration, the book is the website, regeneration.org, which has the largest listing and network of climate solutions in the world and how to do them in very, very clear ways, from an individual to a city to a neighborhood to a company to a classroom to a school to a church to a synagogue to a temple, right on up, you know, and the links and the people are doing that and the organizations that are leading the way and the bad actors if they exist and the ones who are doing great stuff and the books and the videos, the documentaries, the articles and so forth. So you can steep yourself in, say, degraded land restoration if that's what you want to do. But more importantly, it's like people don't know what to do, and then they think they should do something because they ought to do it. And it's actually more important for them to find something that lights them up, you know, and not to think the job is not to save the world. They can't. It's a burden. It'll make you feel bad every morning when you wake up. You want to do something, get engaged with something that actually lights you up every morning. No one wakes up in the morning and says, I can't wait to mitigate. You know, that's talking about mitigation climate. No one knows what the word means anyway. It's like, and so the solution lies in really being involved with something that really, you know, that you're excited about and your friends are, or your neighbors or your network or, you know, whatever it is. And to remember that we are not just individuals. We are networks. You know, we have an extraordinary networks. This is your network. You're on a network. But that, besides that, you have listeners. You've done that. You've created agency for yourself, okay? And we all have. We don't maybe have a radio station. We don't have a megaphone necessarily, but we have these connections to our friends and our family and our neighborhood and our community and the people who respect us and our schoolmates or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, in our companies and cities and so forth. So this is where solutions come from. This is where they reside. They're not going to happen in Glasgow at the Conference of the Parties.
Well, Paul, we're short on time, but Paul Hawken has returned with Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. Hopefully we'll have you back for a return visit. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Stay safe and stay tuned.